Welcome to this podcast from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, featuring one of the remarkable artists and thinkers who's been part of our Arts and Ideas program. You're about to hear from Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg, who spoke at the JCCSF on April 26, 2010. To receive new lectures as they become available, please visit jccsf.org/podcasts and click subscribe. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all so much for coming. I'm Joanna Steinhardt. I'm the program coordinator at the Toby Center for Jewish Life here at the JCC. I'm honored to welcome Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg to the JCCSF. If you've never been to one of Aviva's classes, you're in for a treat. Like many of her cult followers, I first had the pleasure of hearing Aviva teach at one of her weekly Parshat HaShavua classes at Pardes in Jerusalem. In her classes and books, she manages to make the Torah fresh and surprising, and to add multiple layers and nuance to characters whose complexities are only hinted at in the sparse texts of the Torah. Besides being an extraordinary teacher, she's also a wonderful writer. Her first book, The Beginning of Desire, Reflections on Genesis, won the National Jewish Book Award for Nonfiction in 1995. As Talmud scholar Daniel Boyarin wrote in a review, this is not a book to be read, but to be studied, slowly, week by week, a modern midrash in its own right. That review continues, although a written text could never live up to the magic of her shiurim, her classes, we are nevertheless privileged to see the publication of the first volume of her interpretive work. That was in 1995. Since then, we've been even more privileged to see the publication of two more books, The Particulars of Rapture, Reflections on Exodus, published in 2002, and her most recent book, The Murmuring Deep, Reflections on the Biblical Unconscious, which was published last year. But tonight, we are especially privileged to get the real thing. So please join me in welcoming Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg to the JCCSF.
Thank you very much, Joanna. Good evening. Our subject this evening is laughter and Sarah. It turns out, of course, once one begins to study the story of Abraham and Sarah, that laughter plays quite a large role, a surprisingly large role in the story. The fact is, of course, that Isaac is born in laughter. That's why he's named Yitzchak. Yitzchak, which means he will laugh. That is, there's an expectation from the very moment of the conception, or even a year before the conception of Isaac, when his conception is first enunciated, that there will be laughter, because the whole story begins with laughter. And the question that I'm going to be struggling with is a question about the qualities of laughter, about what is it that laughter does, that laughter is not simply a question of meaning, laughter means something, but that laughter does something. It actually changes reality. It reveals something of reality and changes reality. And so I want to be addressing the first narrative of a human being encountering God. This is the first narrative in which God takes the initiative and addresses a human being and says to him, and this is the foundational command of Jewish history, Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha, get moving. Start traveling. Leave everything you know. Leave your home, your birthplace, your father's house, and go to the land which I will show you. Where are you to go to? El ha'aretz asher areka. To the land which I will show you. And of course, what's so obvious and mysterious about that opening shot between God and Abraham at that time, is the unknownness of Abram's destination. He knows very clearly what he's leaving, but he doesn't know where he's going. I will show you when you get there. God doesn't actually tell him his destination to start with. Now that command, Lech Lecha, start traveling, has been interpreted in many different ways. And I want to suggest that the whole story of Abraham, in fact, is a travel narrative. That even when he's formally no longer traveling, he has arrived in the land of Israel, in some real sense, he is constantly traveling. He is the most restless of the patriarchs. He is the one who's constantly on the move. Lech Lecha, therefore, as a travel narrative, and I think of travel then in terms of the English pun on the word travel, travel, travail. And it turns out that the two words are etymologically connected. They are not, it's not just a play on words. In English, travel and travail. And I remember Othello's wooing speech. How did he win Desdemona? Right. They recall afterwards, what was it that made Desdemona fall in love with Othello? They remember. It was his travailous history. It was his traveler's history. And really, you can't tell the difference between those two words in English. The ear doesn't exactly distinguish. Travelous history. Traveler's history could be travailous history. There's something about all the terrible and fearful adventures that Othello has passed through in his life, the terrible battles that he's won and the encounters with mythic creatures, that wins the heart of Desdemona. That is, there's something seductive about a travailous history, about a history of difficulties gone through, dangers passed, movement undertaken, movement and transformation undertaken. That will win the heart of your lady, gentlemen, if that's your problem. If I come back to Abraham, I want to say that the whole history of Abraham is a traveler's history, and it's there to win our hearts. That is, it's there to court us from the very beginning of the story, to involve us in some way that is impossible otherwise, perhaps. We're talking here about how perhaps all narratives, if I really want to extend it, all narratives are travel narratives, and they aim to augment us in some way. They aim to extend our experience in some way, to take us on a journey and to bring us back home, the richer, hopefully, for the journey. And so with this, I wanted to look with you at a midrashic commentary on that word, lech lecha. And there are many such commentaries. This is one I've chosen, as you'll see, because of its unexpected imagery. This is in number 2. We'll come back to number 1 afterwards. This is Midrash Rabbah. God said to Abram, lech lecha. So Rabbi Brachia says, he quotes from the Song of Songs, quotes a beautiful verse, many beautiful verses from the Song of Songs. Thy ointments have a goodly fragrance. Your oils have a goodly fragrance. And Rabbi Brachia says, what was Abraham like? What did he resemble? He resembled a vial, a little bottle, a flask of myrrh, of some kind of perfumed material, which was tightly corked and laid in a corner. V'lo haya recho nodef. So its fragrance did not disseminate because it's closed up and because it's static. Kivan shehayita mitaltelet haya recho nodef. As soon as it was, and then there's this rather mysterious word, mitaltelet, tiltul. As soon as it was agitated, as soon as it was shaken up, I don't know how do they translate it in your English there? Taken up, something like that. That's a really flat translation. As soon as it was taken up, mitaltelet, you can hear it even in the doubling of the root, there is something uncontrolled, unstable about this movement of the bottle, then its fragrance disseminates. So God said to Abraham, taltel atzmecha mimakom lemakom. Agitate yourself, move yourself around from place to place, and then your name will become great in the world. So we see the analogy. It's like the perfume will be disseminated. You will become, your name will become great in the world. It's like perfume. And there is, of course, a strangeness about this analogy between Abraham and a bottle of perfume. Abraham, who is the arch-patriarch, he is the first patriarch, in other words, a really masculine figure. And perfume, which often has feminine connotations, feminine, erotic connotations, that there was something, ungendered now, or cross-gendered almost, about Abraham, that Abraham has a quality about him. It's not just that he will become famous, Shimcha mitgadel ba'olam, but in fact, he will acquire more of a self. He will really become himself. He will become perfume, actually. Perfume that is not disseminated is not perfume. You know, it may be perfume, but it doesn't do perfume. You know, what perfume does is be experienced by people, have an effect on people. It has a very creative effect on people, almost literally. I suppose many babies have come into the world, if you'll excuse me, the analogy, as a result of the erotic effect of perfume, and that's how it advertises itself. But here we're talking perhaps about a specific kind of perfume, and we're talking about a man who is compared to perfume, and about how he is not really doing, he hasn't really found his way of doing Abraham yet. His future being is completely unrealized, and what he needs is this movement, this kind of agitation, which at its most concrete simply means get traveling. But, of course, as you can imagine, there are other levels that I'd like to think about. What kind of movement is God here indicating? And if you look up the word tiltul, that very graphic word, you'll find here's a list of translations, an attempt to catch something of the quality of this word. It means to wander, to be moved, to be confused, to be thrown, flung, swung, hurled. Tiltul, not just taken up. It means distraction, to be distracted in some way, to be a vagabond, to suffer from road fatigue in modern Hebrew, to lose one's balance. So you can get a sense here of the loss of stability, the loss of equilibrium that's involved in lech lecha, as the Midrash now translates lech lecha. That it means doing something to one's whole being, shaking oneself up, so that one becomes who one may be. One begins to do, one begins to perform in the world according to one's potential, according to one's hidden being. And perhaps also, I don't think one needs to censor. One needs to censor the implication also of having some kind of erotic effect on the world. That your being will create a certain desire in people. And so you have a tradition, for instance, that interprets certain verses in Song of Songs as referring directly to Abraham. For instance, Al-Kain Alamot Ahivucha, erotic verse. Therefore, young girls have loved you. And that is understood, you have to fasten your seatbelts here, that is understood as referring to Abraham, who is loved by many people who then become proselytes. In other words, who are so attracted in some way to what he represents, to the perfume that comes from him, that they join him in his new religion. So in other words, there's a kind of conversion seduction effect that Abraham has. It's not entirely intellectual. It has to do with the nature of his being, which is an undeveloped being at the beginning of the story. And that's why God says to him, move. Not just in order to arrive at your destination, you will have to move. Travel as a pragmatic necessity, but travel as a journey in itself. Travel as something that will change you and therefore affect others. The force of yourself will be released as a result. The question is asked, and it's a very good question and an important question, why was Abraham chosen in the first place? After all, Ramban, for instance, Nachmanides, one of the great classic commentaries, points out there is no credit line attached to Abraham when he's first introduced. That is, there's no praise of him, there's no description of him that would arouse interest and would make you think, ah, yes, he was a worthy recipient of God's call. He is simply described in terms of his family setting, and without any particular praise attached. So why indeed was he chosen? It's almost as if it's an anonymous choice that God somewhere just went for Abraham. Why? And what I put on your page in number 3 is a modern Hasidic comment, 19th century Hasidic comment. He, quoting Ramban's question, why was he chosen? After all, even Noah is called a perfectly righteous man, and that serves as the ground for his choice by God to survive the cataclysm, the flood. Whereas Abraham is not described at all in that way. And our Hasidic writer answers rather dismissively, that's not a question. There's no question about this. It's a false question. Because the greatness of Abraham, the perfection of Abraham, was acharkach, was afterwards. It's a future perfection. At the beginning, there really is not that much to say about him. Now, it's true that the Midrash will fill in all kinds of heroic details about Abraham to start with. The famous story of the fiery furnace. I won't go into that. It's not my subject today. But the biblical text is without any background at all. And so our Hasidic writer now comes and says, his greatness is all potential. It hasn't yet been realized at the beginning of the story. And it's only in a way retroactively that you can look at Abraham and understand why he was chosen. This is something that isn't inborn in him, in a sense, but needs to be realized. You can mark the moments of transformation, he suggests, Nisvat Emet suggests, by a couple of significant moments. One moment is the one in which his name is changed from being Abram to being Avraham, Avram to Avraham. A hey is added to his name. What does the hey signify? Well, a number of different possibilities, one of which is the name of God, that hey stands for God's name. Another of which is five limbs of the body. He is the numerological equivalent of five. Five limbs of the body which he didn't really have before he circumcised himself. Very interesting and strange observation. That is, before he performed surgery upon himself and really diminished himself. He took off a part of himself. Right, it's a kind of castration, you might almost say. Before that moment, he didn't really have, as part of his integrated self-image, body image, five organs of the body, hands, legs, and the sexual organ. That is, in some way, he is all over the place. But once he has gone through certain transformations, which have to do, first of all, with changing the name, and at the same time, with circumcising himself, then he is transformed. And in addition to these suggestions, and I'm throwing things at you at the moment, we'll unpack some of it, he is the mark of a question. A question begins with the letter he in Hebrew. And therefore, perhaps there is the idea that what changes in Abraham when he changes his name is the approach to questions. That is, the way in which he lives in a world of questions, rather than in a world of givens, in a world of answers. Well, our Hasidic writer here finishes his passage by saying, it's true, it is emet, he says, it is true that Abraham from the beginning had ahava rabbah. He had great love for God. That is, there was a great readiness, an infrastructure within him, which is called great love. He was ready to follow the call. That it does count to his credit. But everything else that you have to say about him, about you in praise of him, waits for the future. It waits to be developed. And so he is a potential being. That is the way in which Abraham, the first father, begins. From being a father of one nation, Avram, he becomes Avraham. As God unpacks that, Av Hamon Goyim, a father of many nations. And that is the immediate translation that's given in the biblical text about his name change. What does it mean to say that Abraham now is the father of many nations? Biologically, it's hard to say that he's the father of many nations. He's the father of a single nation, I suppose. But perhaps this suggests that his effect on the world is and will be an effect that will diffuse, like perfume, way beyond the boundaries of his own nation. That is, way beyond even those who want fully to throw in their lot with his religion. It nevertheless will have a secondary effect on many other nations and many other religions, which is in fact the case. Judaism has had that kind of diffuse effect on other religions. That is, what Abraham's role in the world is to be is not a parochial one. It's not simply his children who are to be affected. But in some sense, that perfume will be heady. Yes, it will affect, it will intoxicate, it will move and destabilize people who still remain members of other nations and other religions. And that effect is an effect, it's called in Hebrew, there's a wonderful expression, gilui kvod Hashem ba'olam, the revelation of the glory of God in the world. That is, the role of Abraham will be not simply to teach, although that will be part of his role, it will be to reveal by the his very being, the glory of God in the world. Something about how God is in the world will make its way through his being and will reveal itself, once he has developed, reveal itself to the rest of the world. And this process, through his name change, through his body change, this process will reveal what up to now has been hidden. Revealing the hidden. Secrets. So what is Lech Lecha then? Go to yourself. Literally. Go to yourself. You are not in yourself yet. A lot remains to be revealed. In yourself and then to yourself and to the world. Go to yourself. Rashi, the great, perhaps the premier commentary on the Torah, comments on Lech Lecha, go for yourself, go for your own good, for your own benefit, Lehana'atcha u'letovatcha. And this is a rather limited translation. It means pragmatically, if you travel towards the land of Israel, there I will make you into a great nation, there you will have children, here you will not. You will be barren, you will be sterile, you will never have children. In other words, it's in your interest, Lecha. It's in your interest to make this journey, because you will be personally the richer for the journey. The Zohar offers actually a much larger translation. And the larger translation is Letikuncha ulegormecha. Go for the remaking of you and for the transformation of you. Tikkun. The completion. In other words, it's not simply that you will gain benefits from the journey, pragmatic benefits, but you will be changed. And of course, you would have to be a person who's open to being changed, to want to take up God's challenge. If change does not interest you or frightens you, quite naturally, then you would not respond to Lech Lecha. So who is Abraham then? As the same Hasidic writer will say elsewhere, he is someone who responds to that challenge. God may have said Lech Lecha to innumerable people. We don't know. Yes, this is the one who took God up on it and who exposed himself in this way to the hardships of travel, to the challenges of travel. And here now we come and begin to approach the question of laughter. What role does laughter play in this traveler's history, in this travailer's history? What we read, and this is as I approach the theme of laughter, we read just before the story of the Akedah, that is, right at the end of Abraham's life with God, before the binding of Isaac. It's at the end of chapter 21, and at the end of many travels on the part of Abraham, we read this. Vayita Eshel beBe'er Sheva, he planted a tamarisk tree in Be'er Sheva, and he called there, Vayikra Shem b'shem Hashem Kel Olam. And he called out there, he proclaimed there, in the name of God, the God of the world. A single verse. Why this attention to this Eshel? It's a tree that we've never heard of before. It's a kind of tree that, tamarisk tree, it's a very precise translation. But why should it interest us that under this tamarisk tree, he proclaimed aloud the name of God, the God of the world? In some sense, he really lectured, it sounds like. Right? He gave a public lecture of some kind in which he tried to teach about God. And this is not the first time he has proclaimed the name of God, but it's the first time it's been in association with a particular place, like an Eshel of this kind. What does that refer to? And here you have some very interesting suggestions in the Midrashic literature. One you can see on your page is Rashi quoting a Midrash. Number four, Eshel is translated here, leave the tamarisk aside, two views. One is either it was an orchard full of trees. And from this orchard he would offer fruit to all his guests. And there was this is a garden of earthly delights, there was every possible fruit in this orchard. And that was the place where he proclaimed the name of God. And the other view is that it was some kind of hotel, an inn, for people to rest, for people to refresh themselves and eat, and again, all kinds of fruit. And these are the structures that he sets up, one of these structures, either a forest, an orchard, or a hotel inn, and that's where he entertains guests. And when the guests want to thank him at the end of the meal, how does Rashi finish there? He proclaims the name of God through his response to people's gratitude. After they finished eating and drinking, he says to them, "Bless the one of whom you have eaten. Lemi she'achaltem mishelo. The one of whom you have eaten. Do you really think you have eaten of mine, shemisheli, from what belongs to me? You have eaten of the one who spoke and the world came into being." That is, of God. What is Abraham actually doing here? In Rashi's source, it's put like this, that what he actually does is speak to those who have just had oral pleasure. Right? This is my translation, of course. Who have just been using their mouths in a very satisfactory way, in a very gratifying way. And they want to use their mouths now to thank the hospitable host. And he says, it's not of mine, lo misheli. It almost comes to mean, it's not of me you have eaten. It's not of my substance. It's not my stuff you have eaten. It's the stuff of the one who spoke the world into creation. In other words, if you want to thank the origin of your pleasure, of your oral pleasure, if you want to speak out of the same mouth that has just enjoyed the food, then turn that thanks directly to the source of all pleasure, of all pleasurable experiences of food. In other words, it's what I'm calling a kind of oral alchemy. That what started off in the mouth as the pleasure of food is transformed into the words of blessing. Into the words of blessing, acknowledging the God who created blessing through words, through speech, the one who spoke the world into being. And that movement of the mouth to recognize simply pleasure, that's really what we're talking, pleasure, satisfaction, gratification, that is the way, that's the means by which Abraham proclaims the name of God in the world. Now, this is a very strong Midrashic tradition, centering the relationship between human beings and God on the oral, on oral experience. And the experience, that is that primary experience that babies have, it's the first connection with the world, the nursing experience, that primal pleasure, finding a way then to connect that with God through an imagined, right, through an imagined series of links. A development of this idea you can find in the Talmud in Ketubot, and I like the development very much, which plays with the word Eshel. Eshel Sha'al. What do you call that? An acronym? Something like that. Move the letters around, and you get Sha'al, which means to ask, to desire, to wish. What happened in this place? People would be given whatever they asked for. Basically, all the pleasures, all the oral pleasures were opened up to them. What would you like to eat? And basically, whatever your heart's desire desired, your was placed in front of you. From that experience of fulfillment of desire, fulfillment of wish, Abraham moved on to the praise of God. That is, the praise of God is based on that experience of fulfilled desire. The lineaments of satisfied desire. Isn't that a line from William Blake? The lineaments of satisfied desire. That's the human image, he says. That's the fully human. The way the baby looks when he's had his fill. Yes, when he, she has been having a very good time at the breast. And that, in some way, is Abraham's Ishel. That is his means. His means is the mouth. It's amazing what can happen through the mouth. And if I want to complicate the issue, as I do, in case it's not complicated enough yet, I want to suggest that psychoanalytic insight into these oral pleasures yields a rather complex picture. That is, what the pleasure that one has when one eats is also a destructive pleasure. That is, one is actually destroying what one's eating. The teeth are no mean weapon, right? The teeth are there for survival as well as other things. And one eats in order to keep oneself alive. And really, when I say I love food, I am, of course, not loving the food. I am loving myself. And I simply use the food. I use the object to satisfy myself. And that rather ruthless aspect of the oral instinct creates a certain anxiety, I'd like to say. that's why people are self-conscious about eating sometimes, and there's all these complexes around eating and its various effects. Because there's a recognition that this is not purely innocent, that there is something here. You know, why do ascetics do what they do, on the other hand? Because they are conscious of the violence somewhere of that act of eating. And that anxiety and that pleasure and that destructiveness is what Abraham is engaging with when he tries to connect people with God. He's trying to say that God is the source of all that, that somewhere all that is acceptable as part of who you are. The connection with God should be recognized. That's very helpful. It gives a source for an integrated source. When I think of this issue of feasting, we remember that Abraham had before this, made a great feast when Isaac was weaned. I move backward in the story now. So it seems that feasting is something that is central to his life with people. And that's his means, it's his means of proclaiming the name of God in the world. The association that I have when I think of this subject is with a film that came out a number of years ago called Babette's Feast. Ah, I see I'm in film land. It was a film that really made quite an impact on me. I think the time has come to see it again. I made a note in my agenda to see it again when I get back home. Babette's Feast, you remember, is about this rather ascetic Puritan community in a village in Sweden, I think, where everyone is very, you know, prim and proper and uptight and unwilling to engage in any pleasures, and with all the resultant neuroses that result from it and family problems and so on. And there comes a woman to town who is an expert chef. And a lot of the film focuses on her preparations for a feast that she has invited the town to, and the local politics of refusal, of repudiation, of suspicion. People don't want to come to the feast. They're suspicious of the pleasure that's being offered at this feast. And a lot of the film focuses on the detailed, loving preparations. Just a pair of hands working on the food with great love. And then finally, this masterpiece of a feast that is served up to people who have never seen anything like it, and the strange expression that crosses people's face as the food hits the taste buds. As suddenly there's an explosion in the mouth, and suddenly the mouth experiences something that has never experienced before. And the new and transformed religious consciousness that is generated by that experience. When I saw the film, of course, I immediately thought, well, that's very Jewish. I mean, yes, food. I mean, food as a central part of religious culture. And I come back now to the great feast. And this is where, at last, we can begin to laugh. We can begin to encounter laughter. This is chapter 21, verse 8, when the boy Isaac is weaned. Then Abraham makes a great feast. A great feast. What is a great feast? Does that simply mean a lot of food? And one commentary, again, Rashi comments, a great feast means that there were great people there. He invited all the dignitaries of his generation. For instance, Shem and Ever and Avimelech. Avimelech, what a strange person to invite to your baby's feast. Oh, I see a number of people get the joke. Let me try to spread the laughter now. What is funny about inviting Avimelech to the feast? After all, isn't there a paternity issue here? According to the Midrash, and it certainly sits well in the text, when did Sarah become pregnant? Immediately after spending time with Avimelech, after many years of barrenness with Abraham. So, of course, the mockers of the generation, that's what they're called in the Midrash, Litzanei Hador, right? That professional guild that makes its business to scoff. Of course, what are they saying? Of course, that's the father. What does Abraham then do? He includes that rival father in the feast. And he invites him to the feast to witness. To witness what? Extraordinary Midrash then. To witness Sarah giving suckle to the baby, Isaac, the final weaning, she does it publicly. There's a kind of public manifestation of the glory of God, showing that her milk is really flowing for this baby. You know, she's really not past it. That, in other words, this is the miracle publicized in such a way as to silence the mockers. Great laughter was there in the world. What does Sarah say after the birth of her son Isaac, a few verses before this? How old were these parents? The father was 100 years old. Sarah was 90 years old. And Sarah said, Tzchok asali Elokim, kol hashomea yitzachak li. Laughter God has made for me. Everyone who hears will laugh li. What's li? Will laugh to me, will laugh at me. Are they laughing at me? Are they laughing with me, for me? It's an awkward preposition, laughing to me. It leaves things somehow up in the air. What does she mean by everyone who hears will laugh? Who would have thought, she goes on to say, who would have said to Abraham, Sarah is nursing children, that I have borne him a child in his old age? What an improbable idea, but it's actually happened. And her response is a response of laughter. And she talks about laughter and attributes the laughter to God. Tzchok asali Elokim. God made me, well, I suppose the worst translation, I mean the worst case translation, the least pleasant translation, would be, God has made me a laughingstock. Now, that is certainly a possible translation. There's no way of denying that. Tzchok asali, God has made me a laughingstock. Everyone who hears will laugh at me. That is, there's something ridiculous about this. Can you imagine a 90-year-old lady? You know, there's a sense of embarrassment, there's a sense of somewhere normal, rational boundaries, natural boundaries, right? How did people feel when they heard that a 65-year-old woman had had a baby a few years ago? You know, to be honest, it wasn't just that they were happy for her, right? There was a kind of prurient curiosity. There's something here. What is this? And she is aware of that level of things. But, laughter, of course, can mean many different things. It needn't be laughing at. It can be laughing with. It can simply mean joy. Everyone who hears will be joyful. Will be joyful for me, with me. Everyone who hears will laugh at me. How does Rashi translate it? Yismach alai. Everyone who hears will rejoice for me, about me. So what Rashi is doing, and I want to point this out because it's going to be important, is translate laughter as equivalent to joy. Right. Laughter basically means joy. And sometimes he doesn't even bother to translate it, as if there's no gap. Of course, that's what it means. And he quotes then from a surrealistic midrashic source. Harbe akarot nifkadu ima. When she gave birth, so untimely, many barren women were visited with her, were remembered with her. Many sick people were healed on that day, and many prayers were answered with her. V'rav schok haya ba'olam. And there was much rejoicing in the world. There was much laughter in the world. That's what it actually was the text. There was a wave of laughter that rippled throughout the whole world. And Rashi translates that as a wave of joy. In other words, in a sense, he is disambiguating the word laughter. I hate that word, so let me try to find a better way of putting it. What he is doing is simplifying and focusing the idea of laughter on joy and ignoring, in a sense, the other more aggressive, Freudian implications of laughter. And he is isolating the joyful aspects of laughter. And here is where the fascinating question then arises. Abraham laughs and Sarah laughs when they hear of the idea that they're going to have a child. That is, way ahead of the actual birth, what we read is that Abraham falls on his face and laughs. That's chapter 17, verse 7, if anyone is following on here. 17, verse 17. God says to Abraham, Sarah, your wife, is going to change her name from Sarai to Sarah, and I'll bless her, and I'll give her a son to you. And I will bless her, and she will become nations, and kings of nations will come of her. Vayipol Avraham al panav vayitzchak. And Abraham fell on his face and laughed. In other words, he's splitting his sides. Fell on his face, seems to mean in some way he's lost control of himself. He is just convulsed with laughter. He falls on his face and he laughs and he says, shall a 100-year-old man have a child? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? Questions are asked. Ha, beginning with the word, with the letter hey. Shall that happen? And it really does sound as if he is in some sense mocking. In some sense, he is incredulous. He's asking the question that doesn't seem to assume the truth of what has just been said. Can it possibly happen like that? When Sarah heard the news, and that is a little later, God appeared in the form of the three angels who come to Abraham and announce the birth of a child to his wife. Meantime, where is his wife, Sarah? She is in the tent flap. She is somewhere secreted, off the scene, but able to listen in some liminal place there. The angels ask, where is Sarah, your wife? And Abraham answers, she's in the tent. And the angel then says, I will return this time next year, and behold, there will be a son to Sarah, your wife. And Sarah was listening there at the entrance to the tent, which was behind. And Abraham and Sarah were old, coming on in years, and Sarah had ceased to have the way of women, orach kanashim. That is, she was no longer menstrual. That had stopped for her. A whole way of living time had ended for her. Vatitzchak Sarah bekirba, and Sarah laughed internally. Interesting expression, but internally. It's a suppressed laugh, not an out laugh out loud. And she, as if to say, after I have withered, shall I have pleasure? It's one way of translating. Acharei veloti haitali edna. Shall I have satisfaction, fulfillment, pleasure? And my master, my husband, is old. My lord is old. And God said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Saying, shall I give birth? And I am old. Now, she didn't say, I am old. The subject of her incredulity is her husband's old age. But according to Midrashic readings, God doesn't want to make trouble between husband and wife. And so he doesn't report her quite straight. And he changes it slightly, that she really just said, I am old. Meantime, the angel simply defends God's infinite powers. Is anything too wondrous for God? This time next year, I'll be back, and there will be a child. And Sarah denied, saying, Lo tzachakti. I did not laugh, because she was afraid. And the angel said, Lo ki tzachakt. No, yes, you laughed. No, indeed, you laughed. And that's the end of the scene. Right? Nothing else. It's all about laughter. Did she laugh? Didn't she laugh? Why does she deny laughing? Because she's afraid. What is she afraid of? The issue of laughter is left trembling on the surface of the ending there. Now, what can we say then? What kind of laughter is Abraham's? What kind of laughter is Sarah's? The angel seems to be critical of Sarah's laughter. No one is critical, apparently, of Abraham's laughter. Although Abraham also seems to be rather critical in his laughter. So what does Rashi say here? He fell on his face and he laughed. He quotes from the Targum, which is a traditional, perhaps the most authentic original translation of the Torah into Aramaic, which translates laughter as joy. That is, the laughter of Abraham is translated as joy, but the laughter of Sarah is translated as mockery. And from this you learn that Abraham believed and rejoiced, and Sarah did not believe and mocked. And that's why God was angry with Sarah, right, was critical of Sarah, but he was not critical of Abraham. And that's a classic understanding of the difference between two kinds of laughter. That the same word, and I think this is very problematic, that the same word can be used in the Torah, and it's the word litzchok, for two very different kinds of laughter. And one is embodied in Abraham, the laughter of faith, the laughter of belief, of wonder. And the other is Sarah, who is laughing critically and somewhat mockingly, the very idea. How could I possibly? In fact, how could my husband possibly? She knows her husband very well. And presumably, you know, one can read between the lines. You know, I don't have to spell it out. She knows very well that it's really not possible, as far as her husband's concerned. And that hidden life, she laughs inside her. That hidden life, that hidden married life, somewhere expresses itself in incredulity. And God criticizes her sense of the impossibility of this. Now, whenever I read this, I have to say I am rather restless and unsatisfied. Because after all, aside from the honor of women, which I do advocate, there is that embarrassing fact that it's the same word that's used. And if it's the same word, it's really hard to say that it could cover two very different, completely different modalities of laughter. The Hebrew language is rich enough to find some other way of saying it, if you want to have two different kinds of laughter. And so I want to move now on a kind of journey, it's a brief journey, to explore what might the root concept of tzchok be. A root concept that would cover both Abraham and Sarah's laughter. If the same word is used, after all. And as a starting point, have a look at the source in number 7. Vayitzchak, Abraham laughed. And what Ramban says is the same word laughter can sometimes be used of mockery and sometimes be used of joy. And then he goes on, actually, to extend that root, tzchok, to a similar root, but not identical, schok, with a sin and a tzaddik. Kemo misacheket betevel artzo, the word that means to play. That is, play and laughter, he takes as actually covering the same territory. That laughter has about it a play element, an element of improvisation, an element of dealing with something that is not quite real, something that is not implanted in the world of reality. And what he goes on to say, lefida ati, and this is where he's going to express himself very seriously, my opinion is that the meaning of this expression is, it refers to anyone who sees inyan nifla, something wondrous, something that arouses bafflement, wonder in a person, letovlo, something that I'm happy about, then I will laugh in one way. And something that is wondrous and uncanny and unfathomable, but doesn't strike me as so immediately happy-making, then perhaps I will feel uneasy about it and I'll mock at it and I'll some way try to reject it. But what's in common in both cases is this sense of pele. Pele as something amazing, something that throws me out of kilter, that I can't any longer inhabit my previous world of meanings, a world of rationality. My map is in some way blown up. Somewhere, something bursts, right? Like a burst of laughter. Right? Something explodes here. And what explodes is my previous frameworks, for thinking and for plausibility. And suddenly there is something that comes along and presents itself as a possible reality. Some conjunction of ideas sometimes, contrast of ideas. What is it that makes people laugh, right? The man who falls on the banana peel, who slips on the banana peel, this is Bergson's notion. He's funnier if he's all dressed up in a top hat and tails and a tie if he's in jeans. In other words, it's the contrast. You don't expect such a person to suddenly end up flat on his face and suddenly there. So in other words, I mean, there's a sadistic aspect of laughter. The idea of being taken beyond your parameters, being taken beyond the world that you up to now have taken as given. And suddenly laughter breaks you up in that sense. Spinoza said the first great law of thought is non ridere, non lugere, neque detestare, sed intellegere. Not to laugh, not to weep, not to hate, but to understand. That is, if you want to be a truly philosophical person, your aim is understanding what is and not exposing yourself to explosive emotions of one kind or another. Laughter, mourning, hate, all these human explosions, avoid them if you want to be a true philosopher. The first great law of thought. It's Spinoza in the same mode, who will reply to the prayer, the religious prayer, De Profundis. It's written in Latin, but of course in Hebrew it's Min Ha'Amakim, the cry from the depths, the cry from the depths of being. And Spinoza will respond and say that any rational discourse has to be from reason alone, that it's only pure reason that should be operative in our discourse, not these useless cries to God, these cries that serve no purpose and that come from the depths of one's emotional being. Now, that is Spinoza. There's a wonderful book by, I'm just blanking on his first name, anyone help me, Shestov, who was one of the first existentialists. He was a Russian Jew. He lived in Paris. He wrote a book called Athens and Jerusalem, in which he contrasts these two ways of speaking, thinking, being with God and being in the world, one of which depends on a strong sense of necessity. This is the way the world is, and my job is simply to acknowledge it. And the other of which has to do with weeping and laughing and mourning and crying out to God, and in some way trying to express the depths of one's being and to transform the depths of one's being. And that way of being he names as the Jerusalem way of being. Think, for instance, of Socrates, right? The noblest expression of the Greek way of being. As he is about to die, he is just about to drink the hemlock, he asks for his wife to be removed from the scene because she's crying, poor woman. And that's not a dignified way to die. That's not, tears are not the way to go. One has to go in resignation and in contemplative calm. Now, laughter there is a problem. And laughter in our story is absolutely central. What is it then to laugh? Here I'd like to read you a passage from Milan Kundera in a book called The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. The chapter is called On Two Kinds of Laughter. And the argument he makes basically is about the angels and the demons and how they have divided the world between them. He says the good of the world does not require the latter, angels, to gain precedence over the former, as I thought when I was young. All it needs is a certain equilibrium of power. If there is too much uncontested meaning on earth, the reign of the angels, too much uncontested meaning, the angels celebrating the meaningfulness of the world, of life, then man collapses under the burden. This is just too heavy. If the world loses all its meaning, the reign of the demons, life is every bit as impossible. Things deprived suddenly of their putative meaning, of their usual meaning, make us laugh. Initially, therefore, laughter is the province of the devil. It has a certain malice to it. Things have turned out differently from the way they tried to seem. But a certain beneficent relief as well. Things are looser than they seemed. They have greater latitude. In living with them, their gravity does not oppress us. The first time an angel heard the devil's laughter, he was horrified. It was in the middle of a feast with a lot of people around, and one after the other they joined in the devil's laughter. It was terribly contagious. The angel was all too aware the laughter was aimed against God and the wonder of his works. He knew he had to act fast, but felt weak and defenseless, and unable to fabricate anything of his own, he simply turned his enemy's tactics against him. He opened his mouth and let out a wobbly, breathy sound in the upper reaches of his vocal register, and endowed it with the opposite meaning. Whereas the devil's laughter pointed up the meaninglessness of things, the angel's shout rejoiced in how rationally organized, well-conceived, beautiful, good, and sensible everything on earth was. There they stood, devil and angel, face to face, mouths open, making more or less the same sound, but each expressing himself in a unique timbre, absolute opposites. And seeing the laughing angel, the devil laughed all the harder, all the louder, all the more openly, because the laughing angel was infinitely laughable. Laughable laughter is cataclysmic. And even so, the angels have gained something by it. They have tricked us all with their semantic hoax. Their imitation laughter and its original, the devil's, have the same name. People nowadays do not even realize that one and the same external phenomenon embraces two completely contradictory internal attitudes. There are two kinds of laughter, and we lack the words to distinguish them. Well, I enjoy that. At the same time, it's clear on which side he thinks laughter belongs, that laughter belongs to the devil. And the best the angels can do is in some way just weakly to imitate the laughter of the devil and try to make people believe that it can hold an opposite meaning. I'm more optimistic about laughter. I think, actually, that the ground is equal between the two sides, and if anything, it's in the court of the angels that laughter has its truest reach. What can we say about laughter in the case, in the story that we're dealing with here? Where does laughter actually come from? What Ramban suggests is that it has to do with a sense of wonder, with a sense of incredulity. Now, incredulity is not necessarily the same as lack of faith. There is such a thing, perhaps, as incredulous faith. That is, as Rashi himself says, Yesh tmihot shehen kayamot. There are wondrous things that in fact happen. And when they happen, or even when they're posited in words, they release in us a kind of explosive, a spasm of some kind. And it's a spasm, it's like a paroxysm of incredulity, properly speaking. That incredulity is the root. It's the root response that's called laughter. Something is burst at this moment. Something cracks up. And then the question is, how do we relate to that experience? To that experience of going beyond our home area, our basic being. What is it to have a baby, after all? And I want to relate laughter to having babies. To have a baby, Elaine Scarry, who's an American philosopher, has written a very important book called The Body in Pain. And in this book, she talks about the pain of childlessness, of what it means to be childless, to be barren. And she says the issue with having a baby is that having a baby takes your internal being and brings it out into the world. Somewhere the internal state of your organs, right, for the woman's organs, undergoes a change in the time of pregnancy, and that change then is demonstrated in the world when the baby emerges from that inwardness, and emerges as evidence somewhere that I have changed. And somewhere there is that sense of pride about the baby as manifesting something that begins as purely internal. The inner surface of the body, I'm quoting her, is represented and objectified and substantiated out there in the world. To fail to become pregnant, to fail to become, to have, and feel that you don't have the capacity for that process, what that says, Elaine Scarry suggests, is that I am unalterable. That I can't undergo changes. And there is something about me, and it's certainly in age, I am now definitely unalterable. Right? Now I am what I am, what I am. And that already speaks of a kind of death, that nothing can actually really happen to me anymore. That's what it is to be a kara. Now the issue then is internal. What might it take then to be capable of producing children? It's a different way of asking the question. And of course, it's dangerous territory to make generalizations about this. So I hope I won't tread on any sensitivities here. But what I do want to bring, put on the table, is an interesting Hasidic take on this question. It's the Beit Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov of Ishbitz, who says something like this. He says, having a child, and he's talking about Abraham as well as Sarah, having a child is by way of hinting at, intimating to outside, hinting at the inwardness and the depths of one's heart. That is, the child advertises to the world who you really are. Now, of course, that is complicated by the fact that there are two parents, so no one knows exactly who the child is advertising. But somewhere there is this notion that one looks at one's children. I find this particularly potent in relation to one's grandchildren, because there is that distance already. And you look at your children, grandchildren, and there, writ loud and clear for all to see, are things that in oneself are potential. They're hidden. They may be almost unconscious. And suddenly, there it is, you know, crying to high heavens out there in the world. Why are people embarrassed by their children? Right? It's not just a bad upbringing, but somewhere that he is me. He represents my secret life. Now, of course, this with all due caution. Right? I'll put reserves on that, reservations on that. What is it with Abraham, therefore? Why can he not have a child? And the suggestion, right, the tentative suggestion here is that there is something undeveloped about Abraham's inner being, that he needs to develop his unconscious. That is, in some way, he hasn't been allowing the hidden aspects of his being to become real, right, to become operative in the world. And that's why God tells him to travel and to start realizing himself in his connections with people, in the many narratives that we read about Abraham, in which Abraham encounters various difficult situations that have to do with family, starts off with his own nephew, with Lot, and the complicated family background that lies behind Lot. The difficult situations, his relation to his wife, the wife's sister, business. Why does he say about his wife, she is my sister, in order to save his life and endanger hers? Right? What is going on there? His relations to other nations. In each one of these encounters, it seems to me, you don't have simply an exemplary story about how you should behave when you are in such a situation. It's not just a copybook, you know, a textbook, a manual for how you should behave. On the contrary, it's actually a very realistic account of what it's like to be in a complicated situation and to struggle to find the best way of bringing yourself to light, of bringing yourself to bear, and to fail. Actually, somewhat to fail. No, not to satisfy all requirements. And in this sense, what Abraham is doing is bringing himself into being. How do you know the true self of a person? The Talmud asks the question. Bema adam nikar. When and in what situations do you know the true self of a person? And answer is, unforgettably, bekoso, bekiso, uvakaso. Right? It's a play on words. In his cups, in his pocket, when his pocket is endangered, his economic resources are threatened, and when he is angry. Bekoso, bekiso, uvakaso. That is, how do you know a person? When he is beyond himself. The depths of his heart emerge, right? His unconscious, if you will, emerge when he's under stress. And that's when something manifests itself out there of what he normally keeps very well under cover. It's not when a person is wearing talit and tefillin, says the Beit Yaakov, when he's all dressed up and he's dignified in synagogue and he's doing what he should be doing. That's not the true self of a person. The true self comes out precisely in these difficult interactions with the world. And that is Abraham's task, to bring himself into being, to develop and evoke his own perfume. And perfume, as you know, is made of many ingredients, some of them unpublishable. Yes, right. Not somewhere. It's the mix. It's the integration of all these things that will make for the uniqueness of this person. But it won't happen without some rather difficult episodes, without episodes that really try him. In the Zohar, Abraham is discussed as an allegory for the implantation of the soul in the world, the soul in the body. In other words, here he starts off as an unrealized being, perhaps as pure soul, and then he has to enter the world of the body and the world of interactions and emotions and complexity, and that is the difficult and reluctant progress of the soul in the world. The soul would much rather initially not have this adventure, but God inserts the soul into the world and says, off you go, yes, lech lecha. Now, it's not that I want to follow up the allegorical notion here, but just to give you a sense of how Abraham is sometimes considered, that his task is, in a sense, to come down into the world and to enter the world and find out about what his true self is. And the effect will be, as I'm quoting Jacques Lacan here, that his apparent stability of self will receive some kind of shock. It will be shaken up. That word, tiltul, taltel atzmecha ba'olam, shake yourself up, and your apparent stability, which may be, in fact, simply a defense, fleeing the impact of an inner chaos. I'm quoting Lacan. That will be tested, and a different kind of unstable stability perhaps will make itself felt. Fantasies of containment, fantasies of being a simple self, a well-controlled and regulated self, are going to come under pressure now. And that's where the laughter is going to come in. And I want to come back to the laughter in just 1 minute. Meantime, just to notice again, Lacan says, what is the self in the end, the ego, is a sum of identifications, right? It's a collection of identifications, various coats borrowed from the bric-a-brac of the props department. That is, every encounter I've ever had with anybody that has been meaningful in some way leaves its residue in myself. I identify in some way, in some mode of fantasy, with the characters I've met, the people I've met in my life. I identify or anti-identify, disidentify, and all that goes to make up, in the end, the self that I am. It's not some stable and unchanging thing that's there from the beginning to the end. And I think there is a great deal to think about in terms of Abraham when one considers this notion. The Beit Yaakov, our Hasidic source, says one only develops the power to pray after one has become fully differentiated from God. That is, when one is no longer simply a part of God, a pure soul, but one has become a person with desires, then one can pray to God. Then one has something to say. Prayer is basically having something to say, having something to ask for from the depths of the heart. Certain living processes have to come to be. And Donald Winnicott, I can't resist quoting him, in one of his provocative moments, talks about the processes of life, living processes, as involving self-deception, deception, compromise, ambivalence. And anyone who claims perfect honesty, that he is perfectly honest, is actually speaking falsehood. In other words, there is no such thing as 100% honesty. You cannot live in the world with 100% honesty. And the beginning of an initiation into the true self would be a recognition, perhaps, of that fact. So what is Abraham's journey? And I'm trying to move back to laughter now. The journey is a mad journey on some level. It's a journey into madness. This is indicated by the fact that God doesn't tell Abraham where he's going. Tir'u zaken zeh, says one midrash. Look at this old man. Nir'eh kemeshuga. He looks like a crazy man. He's traveling and he doesn't know where he's going. Isn't that the definition of a crazy man? Meshuga. Meshugas, yes. Meshuga means shogea. Shogea, shogeg, means to be all over the place. Right? It means to be wandering. Metultal. It means to be all over the place. There is something of that. It's a destabilized being that Abraham engages with as a result of God's command. Moreover, and I think very, very poignantly, the expression that he uses himself about his early life of traveling is, he says, "Ka'asher hit'uoti ha'elokim," when God made me wander, taf ayin hei, not tet ayin hei, but taf ayin hei, which means to wander, to roam, to be a vagrant. When God first made me wander from my father's house, mi bet avi, what is it to wander? To wander, is it just to go on a journey? Surely there's an overtone there. It's a sense of lostness. To wander means to be lost. It means not to know exactly where you're going. Even if God has set you off on the track, he has specifically refused to tell you where he's going, where you're going. And so in some sense, you are like a compass, you know, with a needle swinging loose, and you don't yet know where true north is or true east. You know, you don't yet know exactly where you're going. And in that condition, what is it then to be a wanderer? Rashi says it's someone who is exiled from his own place. He's no longer in his own true place. And he is not settled. He's called a wanderer. And Ramban, gives this a concrete reference. He says in the number 9 that what Abraham was doing was constantly wandering, noded. He was a vagrant. That's the word navanad, like Cain, a vagrant and a wanderer. Some kind of very difficult condition. He was wandering from nation to nation, from kingdom to kingdom, somewhere in a sense not knowing where he's going, even though Eretz Yisrael is in his mind. He hasn't set a straight track there. He doesn't know in which direction he should be going. And in the end, Ramban wonderfully translates that word, God made me wander, hit'u, by reference to a psalm, Ki haya to'eh kase oved. He was a line in Psalm 119 that he was wandering like a lost lamb. Ta'iti kase oved. I wandered like a lost lamb. And what Ramban is doing here in an intertextual mode is bringing in the associations from the book of Psalms into the story of Abraham, who uses the same word, to'eh. What is it to wander? It's to be like a lost lamb. And the psalmist cries out to God, Bakesh avdecha, find me. Find your servant, seek your servant. I am lost, like a lost sheep. That is, there is a poignancy and a madness about this kind of journey. It's not entirely romantic. It may be romantic to read about it, but to actually be on it is tough. Yeah. And there is a sense of lostness like a lost lamb. The shepherd has to find me because I'm really not sure I can find him. And it's with this sense of things, with this almost tragic sense of things, that I come back to laughter as cracking up. Why does God not tell Abraham right away where he's going? It's a classic question that's asked by Rashi. And one answer that's offered gives a rather strange answer. He quotes from his father, the Shem Mishmuel, another 19th century Hasidic writer, quotes his father, but actually he's quoting the founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov, who says that wherever a man's mind, his consciousness is, that's where he is. That is, whatever I'm able to think about, that's where I really am. So if God had told Abraham, you are going to Eretz Yisrael, in his mind he would already have been imagining Eretz Yisrael. He would know where he's going. And that would, in a way, prevent him from undergoing the journey. I don't know if that sounds convincing. You know, if I know, I think of recent experience as a traveler, if I know that I'm going to New York, or I'm traveling from Tel Aviv to New York, and I know where I'm going to be sleeping tonight, that's very comforting. What's the comfort? That I'm actually not traveling. You know, because in a sense, I'm already there. I can imagine it. I don't have to go through the various stages of letting go, of letting go of what is familiar to me. In some sense, it makes it easier, if you will. And Abraham has to undergo all these detachments and separations. That is, all these experiences of letting go of his previous frameworks and entering into the possibilities of transformation. That can't be short-circuited. And therefore, he has to undergo the sufferings of the journey. And these are sufferings that are not incompatible with laughter, I want to say. That laughter and suffering, on some level, can go very well together. One can laugh in pain. And it's not necessarily a bitter laughter either. It can be quite a joyful laughter. What comes into my mind is a passage from Keats, from one of Keats's letters, in which he says this. He is describing the veil of soul making, and he asks, how then are souls to be made? How but by the medium of a world like this? Do you not see how necessary a world of pains and troubles is to school our intelligence and make it a soul? Right, we may start off with a fully alert intelligence, but that's not yet a soul. And it's a world of pains and troubles. It's a rather lugubrious, of course, Keats writes out of terrible personal experience of pain and sickness and sorrow. And he dies not long after this as a young man. That's what makes one into a soul. Well, where does laughter belong in this? Laughter, again, if I can quote the enemies of laughter, Socrates says, rulers must not be prone to laughter. It's an unacceptable representation in art of a ruler to represent him as laughing. And how much more so, unacceptable to describe a god as laughing. Right. People of dignity, rulers, people who carry the weight of responsibility, should not be laughing. And then I remember how God laughs in the Talmud. When does he laugh? He laughs when he says, my children have conquered me. My children have defeated me in argument. The Tanur Shalachnai, that famous story about an argument among the sages, in which in the end there is a victory over a verse in the Torah, as it were. It's a retranslation of the verse in the Torah to prove an anti-fundamentalist point. And when God hears that his words in some way have been trounced, he laughs and he says, Nitzchuni banai, my children have defeated me. And he laughs as parents laugh when their children defeat them. That is, and it's not a bitter laughter, right? It's a laughter somewhere of triumph. Something has been transcended as it was always meant to be transcended. That my children are doing just what I hoped they would do. That they would achieve the possibility of going one better, right? Of going beyond what seemed to be laid on. And so I come back then to our questions of laughter. What then could laughter be doing? What could it be revealing that otherwise would not be revealed? There's a contemporary poet called Rivka Miriam who writes in Israel now. I love her poetry. In a passage, it's actually a prose poetic passage, she talks about the laughter of Abraham and Sarah. And what she says is very trenchant. She says, that laughter was a necessary laughter if they were to give birth. It was the laughter that made it possible for them to give birth. Before that, everything had been in some way bound by commandment, tzivui. That they had been creatures of commandment, what the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do, and there were no masks, and there were no play, and there was no laughter. Masks is particularly interesting. No idolatry, of course. No other images. And that makes it very hard to have children. It makes it very hard to loosen up enough, right, to release oneself enough, to imagine, right, to engage in the fantasies that are involved in sexuality and are involved in reproducing, in letting go and allowing something of one's innermost self to emerge. In order to have children, laughter became essential. And it's amazing what laughter then does. About revealing something, an aspect of the world, which is also an aspect of God's world. And it's an aspect that otherwise might have forever been obscured. When Sarah laughs, Matitzchak Sarah, this is a laughter that I want to suggest. It's a laughter, She Mikalkelet et Ashura. The classic aphorism is that love spoils the strict lines of things. That love somewhere blurs and changes the strict lines of things, the strict limits of things. And I want to suggest that that's what laughter does as well. That suddenly one sees things in a different light, and suddenly there is this experience of cracking up. What is cracking up? Cracking up is the name of a book by Christopher Bolas, a contemporary analyst living previously in England. And he talks about cracking up as particularly the mother in relation to a baby. I want to give that example. What do good mothers do with babies? One aspect of their good mothering, which he must have witnessed. It's really almost embarrassing. It's a private interlude with the baby. The baby makes some noise, and the mother then, from being quiet and calm and, you know, the gentle mother, suddenly goes crazy. And she starts imitating the baby's noises and exaggerating them. And making funny faces at the baby. And it's all just on the verge of being frightening. That is, suddenly she has become a great clown, he calls it. Suddenly, from being this quiescent, you know, maternal being, suddenly she has become this rather frightening and infinitely changeable being who is cracked up and who shakes the baby up. And the baby is shaken partly by a sense of the unnerving, sense of pele, what's happened to mummy? and the baby, for lack of anything else to do, starts cracking up too. And suddenly the two of them are enjoying a good laugh. But it's on the very verge of being frightening. Right? If she carried it a little too far, then it wouldn't be a joke. That is, that which is funny in that sense, that what cracks you up, that explodes you, is on the verge of being disturbing. Carry it a little further. That's what Freud had to say. He talked about the aggressive mode of laughter. And there is something aggressive about what the mother is doing here when she is shaking the baby up in this way. But apparently babies love to be shaked up. And apparently it's good for babies to be shaked up. A baby that lives only in a quiet, calm environment may be actually missing something. And so what I'm suggesting, and what Christopher Bolas suggests actually, is that about this mode of laughter, there is something of what he calls syncope. Syncope is that mode in which one misses a beat. Yes? Syncopation. It's a certain, it's missing a beat of the heart. The heart goes into a state in which suddenly there's a kind of leap and one comes down on the other side. It's a mode of absence. Suddenly one is no longer there. There's a wonderful book called Syncope by a French writer, Catherine Clément, in which she describes this as a common experience. She's talking about dance, about the tango, about the waltz, about the dervish's whirl, where all of which have this mode of, you know, taking off from the weak beat and then coming down on the strong beat. And suddenly time falters. There's an experience of the absence of self. She calls it a cerebral eclipse. Suddenly it's as if consciousness just goes dark for a moment, and then a return, an apparent death. And many common accidents of the body, many common experiences of the body share in this mode of syncope. Like, for instance, a good laugh, like a cough, like a sneeze, like a hiccup. Suddenly, all your faculties are taken up. That's apparently a quotation from Pascal. Hard to believe. But that the hiccup takes up all the faculties of the soul, he says. Suddenly, there you are, totally lost in a hiccup. It's embarrassing, it's comic, it's degrading, but that's the fact. You are lost in that moment. The sneeze, apparently in Scandinavia, the sneeze is forbidden while driving. You may not sneeze while driving. It's a well-regulated country. And the laugh. The laugh, which in Greek philosophy also has no worthy place. Christopher Fry has a verse play called The Lady's Not for Burning. Let me try a couple of lines on you. I'm not sure how effective it is, but here it is. He talks about the wonder, the genius of God. Would you ever have thought of it, he says, to blow himself to pieces as often as he conveniently can manage it? That seems to be what human beings do with their greeds and passions. Would it also have occurred to you to make him, the human being, burst himself with such a phenomenon as cacination? Cacination means laughter. That same laughter, madam, is an irrelevancy which almost amounts to a revelation. It's an irrelevancy that almost amounts to a revelation. What is revealed? I'm still hunting. I'm still hunting for a core experience here. What is it that the laughter reveals? It reveals, perhaps, the limits of one's reason, the limits of one's body, and the experience of actually having gone over those limits. And suddenly one is out there in that syncope mode in which one is dead. And then one returns to life. And the danger of that mode is what produces the paroxysm, the spasm, the spasm of breath, the hey of the question. Right? Ha ha. I think Voltaire said, another philosopher, said, I never make the ha ha. Right? Rather coldly, I imagine. What is that undignified thing? And I'm privileging that mode, as I understand it, from the Jewish sources, from the biblical sources. What would it mean to lay oneself open to laughter? Yes. And I want to come back to Sarah by way of finishing and perhaps at least partially answering the question. Sarah's laughter. That's the problematic laughter, apparently. That's a laughter that there's a tendency to criticize and to say that was unbelieving laughter. That was the laughter of the devil rather than the laughter of the angels, that she mocked in her laughter. And then I look again at the passage, and Rivka Miriam comes again to my mind. What did Sarah say? And Sarah laughed internally, saying, that is, she doesn't actually say the words. It's her laughter that says it. Lemor means as if to say. So it's not that she actually articulates what she says. What she says is, what her laughter says is, after I have withered, shall I have pleasure. And my Lord is old. And that's when God asks Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? And Sarah denies it. And the angel answers, lo ki tzachakt. She says, lo tzachakti, I did not laugh. You have to hear it in Hebrew, yes. Lo tzachakti, I did not laugh. And he says, lo tzachakt, but with a ki in between. You did not laugh. You did not, you did laugh. It's the negative and the affirmative together. No, he repudiates her. He says, no, you're not telling the truth. You did laugh. But I'm hearing it all in one plane. Lo ki tzachakt. No, yes, you laughed. What is she saying? What is her laughter saying? And there is actually a classic Midrashic reading, and this will be our last Midrashic contribution here, which Rashi quotes, and which I've never paid particular attention to because it seems so counterintuitive. And that is that what Sarah is actually commenting on here when she says, shall I have pleasure after I have become withered? That she's commenting not on an improbable future, but actually on something that has happened at this very moment. Because after all, the verb is in the past present tense. It's hayita li edna. It's not yihye li edna. It's really properly to be translated, after I have withered, I have had joy. I have already had pleasure, joy. That is, something has just happened. What has just happened to her? The Midrash says, demurely, that she has just become menstrual. And what I want now to imagine with you is that moment of breakthrough, yeah, of cracking up, that moment of laughter is the moment also in which she begins to flow. She begins to flow as an effect of the laughter. That is, it's a synchronicity. It's something that happens at exactly the same moment. But it's chak sara bekirba. She laughs in her internal organs. Right? It's a very deep laughter. It goes right down to the place. And there, suddenly, she's cracked up. And that's then, you know, she goes a little mad. And it's a necessary madness. And it's a madness that's made of melancholy. There's no question about it. It's a madness that's made of a difficult journey. The journey of barrenness, the journey of trying to emerge from barrenness. And it means that she's incredulous. Even as it's happening to her, she's incredulous. And she says, can this possibly be happening? And she laughs at it as it's happening. She doesn't believe it as it's happening, which I think is totally realistic in my experience. There is something about that you just can't believe what your body is actually saying. That in some way there could be these trigger responses between something you did and then something that your body did back to you. And suddenly there's that moment of pele, the moment of wonder, which is both unbelieving and believing, right? It's both incredulous and full of wonder. And that's the truest laughter, it seems to me. That's the real cracking up. And when the angel asks, why did she laugh? Perhaps he didn't mean it critically. Perhaps he just wanted to raise the question. In other words, let her not get too used to it. Let her not immediately pass on into a sense of, oh, well, that's, yeah, all in the day's work. But that actually she should retain that sense of the laughter that's at the very heart of faith. At the very heart of faith, there is this sudden explosive sense of things which takes one beyond one's normal, one's proper being, if you will, into one's true being, which is a being in which strange things can happen. Strange flows can begin. And suddenly, what the angel is bringing to her attention is, indeed, you did laugh. She tries to deny it because she's afraid. That is, she's afraid that within a proper God-fearing context, maybe it's improper that she laughed in this way. It sounds unbelieving. And the angel simply affirms her and says to her, no. He says no to her denial. And he says, you did laugh. You did not and you did laugh. That is, you wanted to resist the laughter. I know this is a difficult laughter, but it broke through. And you did indeed laugh. And the angel gets the last word. Right? That's the end of the story. Right? Exit angels. Yeah, up, leave. They leave the stage. And Sarah now knows that God knows that she laughed. That it can't be so internal that it's hidden from God. Right? That might be one imagining. This is so inner that no one knows about it. But that God embraces all that too. And all that, of course, by which I mean the whole realm of the inner spaces of the body and of the mind, of the heart, all that then becomes a focused place. At its very heart is laughter. The laughter of Sarah, therefore, I think, is the essential laughter. And it's the laughter that doesn't only, you know, mean something, but it actually does something. It's the laughter that changes things and that makes things flow, that makes things, close things open. It's the laughter that is at the very heart of faith. Thank you.